We're taking up the issue of bitachon, which basically is translated to mean trust. The attitude that a person who believes in Torah ought to have in terms of his reliance on God. And, to what extent it ought to go, and whatever we can understand about it. I just want to start off, we were discussing recently about prayer. The idea, many people have the idea that those who believe in prayer. But it, to me, it's very, very strange because they try to do these studies, empirically prove, to establish empirically whether prayer is really effective. And it seems to me that such a study is very, very difficult to make, and that it would really be impossible to prove one way or the other. Now, especially when if you're going to, because first of all, how do you define prayer? Since you have many different religions, and each one has a completely different system, and very, very often they contradict each other, both of them can't be true, and that's what they openly say. Most religions maintain that they're the only correct one, and the other ones are false. That is, in effect, they're saying that you're not praying properly. So, I don't know that anybody is saying that prayer per se is a good thing. Now, certainly Judaism doesn't maintain that. You see all the laws that pertain to tefillah, how a person is supposed to prepare himself for prayer, and such delicacy, different kinds of prayer, and the fact is that the wording of the prayer can only be, they can only be composed by people on the highest possible level. It's interesting, I just saw in one of the Sfarim of the Rav, I'm not sure which one right now, perhaps it was in the Rav Thinking Aloud, with regard to the issue of composing special keynote, special dirges for Tisha B'Av, to commemorate the Holocaust. That is, most of the well, they're not really prayers, but I'll just, they're called keynote, eulogizing types of prayers, dirges, as they say, bemoaning, bewailing. But what exactly is a kina? I'm not taking that up right now. But most of them pertain to the destruction. Originally, Tisha B'Av commemorates the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, both of them. And many of them discuss different aspects of that. They're really extensions of the Book of Echa. The Book of Echa, Lamentations, which we read on Tisha B'Av, which is composed by Yeshaya, the prophet Yeshaya. And he was on the level, he had prophecy. So it takes someone on that level to really be able to elucidate the deeper purposes, because we're not talking about the physical aspect of it. We're talking about the metaphysical. So that's something which is very, very difficult for ordinary people to comprehend. And beyond that, they added, it is true, that they added keynote as the years went by. And the purpose of them was to bemoan other calamities that occurred to the Jews. All of them stemming back to the fundamental calamity, which was the exile, the destruction of the Mikdash, and the dispersion. So you have what had took place, terrible, the slaughters in the Middle Ages at the hands of the Christians, book burnings, things of that sort. And there's very little about the types of persecution and sufferings in modern times. And nevertheless, the Rav holds that Tisha B'Av should be, the Holocaust should be commemorated on Tisha B'Av. He's very, very adamant about that, that you shouldn't have a separate day, which makes a lot of sense, because that would imply that there's a separate point over here. It would be a negation. The fundamental idea of Judaism is that all of the calamities that occurred to the Jews have to do with the fact that we're in exile, and that we haven't returned to the proper relationship with God. And that's why they're all designated for Tisha B'Av, and the Holocaust, on one scale, is the worst of them, but you can't isolate it, because what kind of a statement is that making? However, at the same time, there's not that many keynote pertaining to the Holocaust. And according to what's written in that book, Rabbi Soloveitchik was against it altogether, which makes it very, very difficult, because the reason he held is that he held that you have to be on a certain level. In order to compose anything which constitutes a liturgy or a prayer, you have to be on a certain level. The ordinary individual can't, he says it's just the ones that he's seeing, you know, they have the sense of being like copies. You know, somebody's very, very clever, he can imitate a style and maybe write a short story or a novel, but it's not really original. It's something which he sort of, he knows how to mimic and imitate. He doesn't sense that there's any truly authentic, a keynote, or people on the level that can compose them. So I'm just mentioning all of this. If that is the case, then you see how in Judaism, it's not the fact that the person is praying to God itself. It's the manner in which he does so, that the prayers have to be with a certain type of kavana, all kinds of laws pertaining to the state, the concentration, and what you're saying, and who you're da lifnei miato made, know before whom you stand, you know, things of that sort. All of which leads to the conclusion that if a person has a faulty idea of God, of essentially his concept of God is really flawed, so that would eliminate the validity. It's not a prayer, it's not being addressed to God. Not to mention what exactly he has in mind and what he's saying, the words of the prayer. Because for us, as I mentioned, for us prayer is not a gimmick. For most people, they look at it as just a gimmick, some kind of a magical incantation, which is supposedly to influence God. It's a very magical type of a phenomenon. And we discussed recently that the whole idea of prayer is different. If you ask the ordinary person, why should God answer your prayer? What do you have in mind anyways? Well, how do you understand such a thing? That there are two people, and one person, they both have a similar problem. One person didn't pray, and the other person did pray. So why should that matter? In your understanding, why does God respond to him? I doubt if people can answer that question. That idea is a projection. A human situation, obviously, you feel that in order to get a help, to get a benefit from someone, you have to make an appeal to the person. So if you don't bother, if somebody doesn't bother to appeal, that's because a human being is limited. If somebody comes to me and asks me for something and pleads with me, so there's a good chance I'll respond. But if somebody, another person doesn't, so I'm not going to respond. Now, why would that be true with regard to God, who is all-knowing? I don't know how people would understand that, but I think it's, in many, many senses, it's a narcissistic type of thing. That they think that they're special and they're deserving of help. And for some reason or other, if they appeal, it's like a child appealing to the parent. You feel you're making some kind of an impression. However, the idea that we have is that getting the thing you're asking for is not even the most significant aspect of prayer. It's really an obligation. It's an obligation to pray every day to attain a certain awareness of the nature of reality. And the whole purpose is to elevate ourselves. And as we elevate ourselves because of our awareness of the fact that we're created beings, and we strive to obtain a greater understanding of the existence of God, of the Creator, and then we review our purpose in life and how all the various things that we need. As we've seen, most of the requests are not even for the physical things, for redemption and for judgment and justice and things of that sort. So it really has to do with the fact that as a result of the prayer, you elevate yourself and the prayer becomes worthy. That's what the Rambam says. The whole purpose of davening with the minyan is that tefillah is heard. So we have the concept of a prayer which is heard, which is accepted. And then I said many times, Shema, we even pray that God should hear our prayers. And then that the Ritzeh, that it should find favor. From all of these proofs that I've cited, especially Ritzeh, that it should find favor. That's part of the idea of karban. V'nirtzelo, the whole idea of karban, of sacrifice, and prayer is modeled after sacrifice, is that it should find favor with Hashem. Find favor with Hashem means that the performance is done in a manner which has truth to it, which is in line with His will, and really reflects an elevation of the individual who's engaging in it. So for all of these reasons, how can you just say that we're going to make a test, and the test is going to be based upon all people who pray, whatever their concept, whatever their prayer, etc. The whole idea is absolutely meaningless. Therefore, I'm saying that, to the best of my understanding, even in a general way, without being able to elucidate all of the ideas of divine providence, it doesn't make any sense to me. Well, first of all, I maintain that you can't make you wouldn't be able to devise a test, because on the basis of what I've said, there's so many factors that go into it. That it's impossible. The mere fact that the person says that he prayed is meaningless. We don't know. Well, we don't know where the person stands before God. As the Rambam says, only God knows. And there's no guarantee. We don't maintain that there's a guarantee that every time you pray for something, you're going to get it. Or even that the prayer is heard. And therefore, there'd be no way of knowing. Even among people that profess to pray, we have no way of knowing the validity of the prayer. Now, how much more so would that be with people that are not even praying according to our concept of prayer? So it's like they're not praying. Thus, I maintain that in accordance with whatever we know, the system of divine providence, that there is such a system, and God does relate to people, based upon their level and many factors, this would be completely, prayer being one of them, this would be completely outside the realm of providence. That I know of no such principle that maintains that anybody who prays, and there's a system where you pray, you get it back. Now, of course, Gentiles can pray. If they renounce idolatry and they recognize the creator of the universe, and they use a form of prayer, which is a Jewish form of prayer, which is a valid one, yeah. So of course God hears their prayer. That's a different story though. Therefore, any studies that will show a clear pattern that purports to prove that practically speaking, pragmatically, that those who pray have a better recovery rate, I'm very suspicious of them, to put it mildly. The only way I'm saying that it could possibly, let's assume, first of all, it's very, very hard to collect data on these things. And also, you see the magical character of it. Because it means even if the person didn't pray himself, he was prayed for. So then that means it's like you have this phenomenon today. You put various names on a list and they get sent out on the internet and people have no clue who they are, and they're praying for these people. So what kind of a valid prayer is that? It then becomes something which is a magical pill type of phenomenon. You just have to be on the right list. So it's contrary to all of the ideas of divine providence. It's making it into a system. Now, the only thing I said was that it would be feasible. I'm not saying it's going to happen. It would be feasible because it reminded me of a Rambam that talks about a false prophet. That we have to determine whether a person is a true prophet or a false prophet on the basis of certain criteria, absolute criteria. And we have to be able to overcome any emotions to the contrary. The emotion being that if we determine, because of certain objective criteria, that so-and-so must be a false prophet, let's say he prophesies in the name of an idol, or let's say he comes to us and with a message that would be the message that God has told him to inform us to change, to eliminate one mitzvah, or to add a mitzvah, anything which, according to the laws of the Torah, are absolutely can't be. That the Torah itself says you that the Torah, that it's eternal, that you can't add to the Torah, you can't detract from the Torah. So it's something which we say would contradict the prophecy of Moshe. At that point in time, this person must be adjudged a false prophet. However, the Torah does add that if he performs miracles, even if he should perform miracles, and even if they should be the most unbelievable miracles, you should not listen to him because he's a false prophet. Your mind tells you he's a false prophet. So you can't be overwhelmed by the demonstrations. And then, of course, the question arises, well, how is it happening then? And the answer is, the Rambam says that God is testing you. If that should occur, then that should be interpreted as a test. And then Irina asked, but why would God test us that way? So I just suggested, I can't give a definitive answer, why would God test? I'm merely saying, what? Sometimes you have to look not why, but what? What would it be testing? What would be the ultimate objective of that kind of a test? Would be to see whether we love God, whether we serve God with our minds, and we adhere to what we know to be true, in spite of the fact that there's a tremendous temptation. There's a tremendous temptation to just follow the awesomeness of the miracle. That's the rest of the world believes that. That if a person comes along and claiming to have special powers and all of that, and we're skeptical, which we ought to be, and then he performs a miracle, so you'll see the masses of people will join him. They'll be overwhelmed. Because for them, that's all. He's Superman. He must be true. However, the perfected individual will not follow a person in falsehood, even if he should be able to perform these deeds which cause astonishment. So we'd say God is testing us, but it wouldn't change us. That's the only reason I could suggest, if that were to happen with a false prophet. The next question that came up, however, was not exactly the same. It had to do with a concept of bitachon. And that is that... The notion of taking students or yeshiva students, whatever, and just putting them in a dangerous situation and telling them that this is a test of your bitachon, of your trust in God, and the notion being that this is a legitimate thing, that a person has a right to do things like this because he has... That is, the more bitachon that you have, the more trust you have, so then you can sort of do whatever you want to do, so to speak. This is contrary to the fundamental principles of Torah, in my opinion. I know of another situation in which this type of an idea occurs. It's a very popular notion that many religious people have with regard to parnasa. Sustenance, with regard to making a living. There is a school of thought or whatever, a group that believes that it's quite appropriate for a person to engage in learning and not really be concerned about developing a profession or a business, whatever it is. And because why? Because he has trust in God. To cultivate, and they encourage that to the extent that the person who, to the contrary, puts time and effort into learning a trade or whatever it is to earn a living, okay, they may not condemn it, but that's seen as less trust in God. If you really had trust in God, then you wouldn't have to do that. So they look at that as being a virtue. The one who enters into life less prepared, practically. Why? Because he has complete trust in God, that God will take care of him. Why? Because he's serving God, he's studying Torah, whatever it is. The question is such an idea an appropriate expression of bitachon? Bitachon is the Hebrew word for trust. Emunah, faith. I could use the words interchangeably in this situation. And we're using the word trust because emunah, generally speaking, faith means faith. The way it's used is with regard to the basic conviction of the existence of God. That God exists, that God created the world, and everything exists because of his will. Whereas trust seems to be a different development. That is, a person can believe in God, that God exists, but he can, in his own personal life, he can lack trust. He doesn't trust God when he's supposed to trust God. For example, in the situation in the wilderness, when God brought forth the manna, and they were commanded only to take just what they needed for that day, and to have trust that God would provide for them. They don't have to worry about this and take more. So people who couldn't reach that level of bitachon would take more, would violate the command of God. So that's having a different kind of faith. That's having a certain trust that God will keep his word, so to speak, or that God will provide for me. That's a trust in the basic goodness of God. That's really the challenge of life, more so in this regard. That is, many, many people will profess that they believe in a God. The idea of a supreme being, of a God, is implanted to a large extent in people's hearts, psyches. They have a certain sense. So a lot of people will claim that they believe in God, but trusting in God is something else. That is, to live your life in a way in which you've incorporated the idea of trust. Now, of course, the question is, though, at what point is the trust a legitimate trust, and at what point is it not legitimate anymore? Because you can't just say that you could put yourself in any, if this were true, that all that is required, that protection from God, all that is required is that attitude of faith, that I'm willing to do anything because I sort of like close my eyes and I have such belief in God that therefore nothing can harm me. It sort of puts me above the laws of nature. That absolutely, that's kind of, the whole Torah is against that. You're not, clearly, ain't so clear, you're not allowed to rely on miracles. And this idea is brought out, one should study the chinuch on the mitzvah of Makeh. Makeh is the railing around the roof. That's very good to review because he goes through these basic principles. And he talks about the idea of divine providence. And he says about the different levels of people, though, that we do see that certain people were on a very, very high level of protection to the extent that they entered the lion's den and God protected them. But he says these people are very, very rare, very few individuals. And even they, even those people like Avraham and Daniel, etc., at the outset, when they first started out, they were not in that level of divine providence. So he's bringing in this factor of the level of the individual in terms of his closeness to God. But he says the majority of mankind is subject, it's God's will, that we should be physical beings, and he put us in an environment which functions according to the laws of nature, so that's what we have to do. That's the truth, that's the reality. And therefore, of course, that too, a person has faith that if God gave him the capabilities and God designed nature in a certain way, that if he acts correctly, he'll come out okay. And he can also pray for divine assistance. But the divine assistance, as we've studied many times, it's assistance. That is, you do what you have to do. And if you violate that, if you ignore the laws of nature and you act contrary to them, then you're going to suffer the consequences. It's not even a punishment from God. That's the laws of nature. Those are the laws. If nobody would be so foolish as to go into boiling water, take a shower with boiling water, and imagine because he has faith, nothing's going to happen. That notion that it's going to protect you from reality is an absurdity. And we don't see that anywhere. We do see it. The story of Avraham and the fiery furnace, or Daniel, the fiery furnace, or the land of the den of lions. That's not because, in those cases, it's not that these people decided that they don't have to be concerned about reality. That's not true. You see, Avraham Avinu, when there was a famine and he left the land, and then he was concerned about Sarah and he came up with a plan. at no point do we see that he just abandoned himself from responsibility and let God work it out. But the only reason he did it was because it was a situation where it was a test that the demand was that he acknowledge idolatry or enter the fiery furnace. So that was his emunah. His emunah, his trust. That's a good... Well, what kind of trust? How do we understand that? That he knew that no harm could befall him because of his special relationship? I don't look at it that way either. He had ultimate trust in God that this is the correct thing to do. And that ultimately, the perfection of the soul, even if it means sacrificing physical existence, that the whole purpose of physical existence is to perfect the soul and to acknowledge God. And he had absolute faith that that's the correct thing to do. So he did. He did it. And as a result of that, because of that, he was on such a level that that itself puts him on that level where he was worthy of divine protection. But it's not, I don't think it means that a person like that knows that no harm can befall him. It's never that clear to anyone. You see that it's never that clear to anyone because, again, no perfected person has that cavalier attitude that he doesn't have to worry about reality, the physical reality. Even after the war of the four kings against the five, when Avraham intervened, the raid to rescue his nephew. Now, I gave shiurim on that because I said that's a big challenge because when you read it superficially, that looks like recklessness. Of all the cases mentioned, that would conform the most to the case, that purported case that the Cal is mentioning about just putting yourself into a situation and then let your faith take you through it. But it's not the case. I'm not going to go over it now, but I've given shiurim on that to show that he operated with great preparation, with wisdom, with rationality. Did take a risk. Definitely did take a risk. Because and a person has to calculate. There are situations where it's permitted for a person to take a risk and to have bitachon. But when he has the bitachon, it's not that he knows. It's not that he knows. The bitachon is that this is correct and he's doing the right thing. You see that after that war, that God comes to Avraham and tells him, Altira Avraham, do not be afraid. Anochi Mogen Lach, I will protect you. So, why was he afraid? He was afraid because there could be retaliation. He's living in the world of reality, and he undertook the mission. He calculated, and the calculation was whether this is important or not. And Lot was a great person. Lot was his brother, so to speak, actually his nephew. But it says he heard that his brother was captured, and he recognized a loyalty to Lot. To Lot had left or cast them with him and reached a high level and so forth. Then they split. Whatever, I'm not going into all the reasons right now. But he determined two things, that it was very, very significant. It was very important to help, to try to save him. But I would say he had to have come up with a plan that could work.
Hello?
It's clear that the Pasuk makes it clear, Vayarek Eschanikov, that he armed his trained men, that the Torah doesn't go into this in detail. It's something we have to deduce, we have to infer, that he made preparations because he knew that he was in a hostile world and he faced dangers, and he trained, when he had enough men, it says 318 men. When he had enough people, he would train them. Because you see, they sprung into action. And they had a plan. They took the other side by total surprise. They split up. There was night fighting. And they were able to inflict a tremendous... It was a raid. A tremendous blow. But afterwards, of course, he had to be concerned about consequences. You see the same thing by Yaakov. You will not find any case in the Torah that illustrates the other idea of bitachon, that people just do whatever they feel like doing and they just depend upon their faith to see them through. When Yaakov is about to meet with Esav. And also, by the way, the Rashi says this, the idea that they're always concerned that they're not worthy of divine providence. That's another major theme. They never, when they pray to God, they never base it on worthiness. They always base it on what's the chen, matnas chinam, that because of God's mercifulness, because of the goodness of God, not because that they in any way deserve it. They're always concerned that they may, whatever merit they have, they could have sinned, they could have lost that merit. So they're never ever complacent about that. And there too, you see that Yaakov makes every preparation. And how carefully. I wonder how these people would look at that. The tremendous amount of care that not just that he prepares a bribe, but the way he goes through it, selects the animals and so forth, and arranges and who should go first and how to maximize within the framework of the laws of nature. So then, of course, he prays. Because, as we said, that's the true idea of trust. That's the combination that a person has to do everything that's in his power. But he's aware that he can't control. He can't control all the factors. And that there are so many other factors outside of his control. And the only one who can arrange them in a favorable way is Hashem. For those who act intelligently and for the right purposes and who are close to God. That is, in my opinion, the correct idea of trust. The other idea of trust is a haughtiness. I'm not saying they intend to be haughtiness. They think that they're the most humble. They think that by not doing anything, by not taking any steps, and just putting their reliance on God, they think that makes them more religious. But the truth is it makes them less religious. Because you're bucking the system and you're sort of putting yourself above reality. Well, what is humble about that? So that when it comes to a parnasa, person wants to learn Torah, live a Torah life, and get married and have a family and all. So it's completely irresponsible and it's contrary to Torah to just say, I'm going to just go ahead and I'm sure it'll work out. He's elevating himself above the laws of nature, and he's making himself more holy, that he's so holy, he's so special, that God will just cause things to happen for him. Rather, he has to do whatever is in his power to do. Now, of course, it's selecting the lifestyle, the level, it's very meritorious. If the person says he doesn't need a lot of materialism, and he's not striving to have the beautiful house and so on and so on. He's willing to deal with something much more modest because he wants to free himself so he could spend most of his time studying Torah and things of that sort. That's very meritorious. And indeed, it makes it easier for him because it's much easier to find the type of, parnasa that... If you can get by on less, that's perfectly legitimate, as long as it's reasonable. But he does what he has to do. You see that? I mean, the Gemara talks about these great rabbis that were not above doing what people might consider menial, chopping wood and things of that sort. And they'd open up a store and keep it open for a few hours, like Rashi supposedly had a wine store or something. And then as soon as he had what he needed, he'd close it and go learn. That's perfect, but they all acted within the framework of the laws of nature, and they had the bitachon that if they lived, see, there's where the bitachon comes in, that if they lived that kind of life, whose whole purpose is to elevate them, and the material is a means to an end, then Hashem will help them. That requires a great deal of trust, of belief, because you're going against the tide, and seemingly... You know, you're just going in for a few hours a day. And that doesn't seem to be a prescription for getting a lot of money. But you have a plan. And you base yourself on the fact that we say, Lo ra'isi tzaddik na'azov. That I haven't seen a tzaddik who's abandoned. That's always misquoted very, very frequently. So that I believe that there is an appropriate type of a bitachon or a muna and an inappropriate one. And it's not that difficult to differentiate between them, what the determining factor is. This seems to be the most significant determining factor. Indeed, in Kedushin it says that a father is obligated to teach his son the Torah and the profession. He has an obligation to teach him a profession. And it says whoever doesn't teach his son a profession, means a livelihood, is basically, it's akin to teaching him to be a thief, which the Gemara discusses. What do you mean, a thief? It means that you're putting him in a position where he will not be able to sustain himself. He won't be able to earn a living. So what will he do? He'll wind up stealing. All right? Doesn't have to be that way. It's taking it to an extreme situation. But whatever it is, either he'll wind up stealing or he'll cheat people. If it won't be overt stealing, he won't be able to be as honest as he ought to be. Or maybe he'll wind up being a beggar, dependent. It doesn't matter. You see, but it's because that's an obligation that no one has the right to say, well, the father will say, well, I'll teach him so much Torah, he'll be so holy that he won't need to have a profession. Apparently that's not a legitimate idea. And it's rooted in a certain notion. I think it stems from a certain underlying powerful philosophy. If people were to look into it, I don't think they have the ability to notice the emotion behind it. There's a certain powerful emotion. For many, many people, religion is a panacea. It's sort of a escape from reality. To whatever degree, whatever level. Most religious people, not necessarily Jews too. There's a certain powerful religious feeling that people don't want to think about it, and they don't want to analyze it. But a lot of it is really not so religious. It's kind of like the same feeling that people play the lottery. They feel a certain sense of being different and special. It's a narcissistic feeling, and that they're a lucky number, and that's the idea of a lucky number. It's just the question of what exactly is that force out there that's going to rearrange reality in accordance with your wishes. That's how it should come out. The things should come out in accordance with your wishes. So that, I think, is the is what's affecting the situation. People want to have, it's a childish feeling. People want to have that feeling. That feeling gives them a certain security that if I'm out there and I just have faith in God, that's all I need. That's how close. God is like a super father figure to them that will protect them that way. But that's an inappropriate idea. Okay, we're taking up a question that's being raised pertaining to something in the Rabbi Soloveitchik Haggadah, An Exalted Evening, on page 74. The third paragraph, which says, on a communal fast day, we insert into the blessing of Goel Yisrael, that means the Redeemer of Israel, the words, quote, the one who answered our forefather Abraham at Mount Moriah. He will answer you and listen to your cries today. Yet we do not find that Abraham prayed to God at the Akedah. That's a good question. Yeah, we always say that. We say that in the Slichos, Mishana. That's one of the formats of prayer. The one who answered so-and-so, so-and-so. In this we mention the one who answered Abraham at the Mount Moriah. As though God, then if you read the story, it doesn't, to the contrary, Abraham wasn't involved in praying to God at Mount Moriah. The Midrash, so he quotes the Midrash, tells us that at the very moment that Abraham reached out with his knife to slaughter his son, tears streamed from his eyes and fell into Isaac's eyes, while his heart was filled with happiness because of the fulfillment of God's request. Abraham was also experiencing the powerful emotions of a merciful father on the verge of losing a beloved son. God, who sees our afflictions, saw Abraham's tears and answered them, even though Abraham did not beseech God to save Yitzchak. God answers even prayers that are never expressed by our lips and are solely contained within our hearts. I offhand, my first reaction would be to say that a person like Avraham, where all of his thoughts, the Rambam describes that in the Laws of Tshuva, chapter 10, he talks about the service of love, that all of a person's emotions, all of his energy is focused on God. He's always aware of God, everything in every action that he does. So too, when he has a deep pain or yearning or crying, so then that's directed. It's part of that whole phenomenon. Even if he doesn't express it in words, it's something which would be akin to a prayer because of his closeness to God. So I think that that's basically the idea. That's what he's talking about, prayers that are never expressed. Because it is a prayer. The person's in a state, but for whatever reason, he may not have an opportunity to actually verbalize it. But all the emotion, all of the thought of the state of the heart is a prayerful state. So if a person is worthy, so God will respond to that too. It's not, that is to say, if a person is not praying to God because of whatever reason, he doesn't see the need to do so, so then there's no prayer there. He's disconnected himself from God. And through prayer, a person reconnects to God with regard to a certain particular, and if the prayer is worthwhile, so God hears it. But he's saying over here a different idea. It's interesting to think about that in what way did God answer Avram at the Akedah? What he's saying over here is that sometimes a prayer, that it's possible to talk about a prayer that's not verbalized. That's what he's saying. I think this sort of is being subsumed in the category of prayer. It's sort of an extension of the idea that even though it's not verbalized, you could see that. It would be akin, for example, to tshuva, that there's a state of the mind where the person experiences the regret and where he is determined to change and not to do it again. So inwardly, in terms of the mind, he goes through the process of tshuva. So he's in a state of tshuva, but he hasn't verbalized it. It's a mitzvah to verbalize it. It's the highest level. But if he didn't, but he achieved that change inwardly, so that's still tshuva. He's still about tshuva. It's pretty evident from all that the Rambam has said that let's say for whatever he's too weak or he's on his deathbed and all of the mental aspects of tshuva are there, the emotional aspects. I would say a similar thing over here. He could be in a certain prayerful state. His heart is directed towards God and all of the pain that he's suffering, but it causes him to have a certain attitude towards God, a prayerful attitude. So that's the unexpressed prayer. But that doesn't contradict, this presupposes an individual who has the correct ideas, correct notions of a prayer. And it's just that he's not expressing it. As opposed to what people engage in, which is not the correct idea of prayer. And they have a certain... You know, these are the same people that have their good luck charms. They have their saints. You know, they pray to their saints. That's a completely erroneous phenomenon. And they're not directing themselves to the Creator. So that, I'm saying, is not prayer. And whether God sees any reason why to help these people, that's something else. But we're talking within the framework of prayer, that we have a certain concept of what constitutes legitimate prayer. And that doesn't fall into the category. We're not saying that God never takes mercy on a person, simply because of the fact that other factors can be present. And God can take mercy on a person, even though the person doesn't have the correct ideas. I'm not saying that that can't happen or doesn't happen. That's something else. No, nobody can speak in an absolute sense about what God does and God doesn't do. We just deal with whatever has been revealed to us and try to understand it. But that would be something other than the idea of prayer, if that were to occur. What's difficult about the interpretation over here, that God actually answered, the question's a good question. We don't see that Abraham prayed. That's one of the questions that everybody asks. That, why didn't? In this, everybody perhaps read this whole, I didn't read the entire commentary. It has to do with in the Haggadah that God saw our affliction. He saw our suffering. And the Rav says there are certain travails and events in a person's life that cause him to scream and cry out to God for relief. And we find reference to this type of prayer in the preceding passage when it says, quote, God heard our voices. However, there are other calamities that a person suffers in silence, in which he does not call out to God. Such was the case here, where Israel's travails included the most private of domains. However, God, who sees everything, is cognizant of these afflictions, and it is with respect to these calamities that the author of the Haggadah cites the verse, and God took cognizance of them. God hears the cries and suffering contained within a person's heart and provides salvation for all of his troubles. I think that's a different idea. They didn't pray, but still in all, God had mercy on them. And does that apply to everybody and anybody? I don't know. The Jews were special. They had a special role to play. And God calculated the end, so to speak. So they were under the divine providence. And the fact that they were undergoing a certain degree of suffering, it evoked a response, so to speak. But that's different than prayer. Getting back to the Akedah phenomenon, that's tantalizing. Because people ask the question, then why didn't Abraham pray, as he did for the people of Sodom? That's a major question. And also, it seems that that was the whole point, that Abraham committed himself to fulfilling the will of God in spite of the fact that it went contrary to his emotions. That's the test, that he overcame his mercy to do your will. He was able to carry out the will of God under the most difficult of all circumstances that could possibly confront a person. And when the angel called out and told him, do not lift your hand against the lad and don't do anything to him, that wasn't because Avram prayed. That was because he had fulfilled the test. It wasn't God's will that he should kill his son, rather to see whether he was willing to do so. And once it was clear that he was willing to do so, the test was over. So it's very difficult. Where did God answer him? And even if you say that, according to the Midrash, that inwardly he was praying that God should stop it or something along those lines. First of all, that would be probably, I mean, I could understand that, but that would indicate that a certain part of him was unable to go along with this. Emotionally, he couldn't go along with it. But all right, so you could say that's part of the test. In spite of the very powerful emotion that was affecting him, it didn't stop him from doing the action. But to say that God's command to not go ahead with it was because of that is very difficult. Because that's not the case. God didn't change the plan. The plan was that there should be a test, and that he should not kill him. So those are some of the things that I find difficult. I would add to this concept that perhaps it's along the lines of the we've learned the halacha that when you visit a sick person, so you're not supposed to sit alongside of where his head is, because the divine presence, so to speak, again rests at the head of the chola, the sick person. And the way we explained it is that there are certain situations which, by their very nature, draw a person closer to God. One of them being when he's very sick, when he's, a person's very sick, so naturally he's concerned and he's in a different kind of a state. He's much more focused on God. So that's the idea, that the divine presence is there because he's close to God. And perhaps that's what it means when a person undergoes certain afflictions and for whatever reason he can't express himself, but it brings him in a state where he really recognizes God and he longs for God. So that state is a higher level. So God will answer him in that situation, just like the chola. But of course we say that the chola should pray for himself, because the most significant prayer is that which a person says for himself, because that really, kavana is the most important thing. So that the greatest kavana and focus and concentration is when you're suffering. It only means to say that sometimes you may not be able to pray in your illness, but you're still closer to God, and God will respond because of your closeness to Him. That's what I think this means. I think it's akin to that idea. I just say off the record, I don't know if this is a valid explanation of God answering him. I'm just going to put it out there, and we'll see. That according to this, we have to infer that Avram was engaged in prayer. That there was a prayer. I mean, look, it wasn't just, the test was not simply to take him and to slaughter him, it was to offer him as a sacrifice. And a karban is a form of prayer. Because the tefillah now is a substitute for karban. Now I'm speculating. If so, if we are to assume that Avram was engaged in prayer while he was engaged in bringing the karban, he was praying to Hashem, what would he be praying for? See, in a certain sense, that no matter what happens, what's interesting is, what I'm thinking about, is that he did this, you know, he bound him up, and was about to slaughter him. And then, of course, the angel intervenes. And we don't know all the particulars, but even so, you'd say, okay, even so, so he wasn't killed. But what kind of a relationship are you going to have after that? That seems to be so destructive. There's a way to go from there. I mean, imagine Yitzchak. That Yitzchak shouldn't be destroyed. That is, that they emerged unscathed. You have that thing, Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav, the two of them went together. And the amazing thing is, I mean, nobody really goes into this, because the Chumash doesn't really go into the particulars, that the relationship remained intact, and they left in peace. And Yitzchak went on to become the leader. There was no rebellion, and there was no... That the Emunah, it was a test of both of them. That both of them survived the test. Now, one could imagine that was the... Avram didn't know the outcome, but he would pray for himself and pray for Yitzchak. And there was a point when Yitzchak recognized what was going on. And yet he didn't give up his amunah in God. And when it was over, he didn't have any animosity to his father, because he understood why he did it, and probably he benefited from it. Now I'm not sure if that's contained in the Midrash and so on, but maybe that's something. Maybe that was the prayer. We're not told what the prayer was. Their relationship was such that it withstood this. Indeed, I would say it was strengthened by this, because they went through it together.